Noticing my anxious expression, Tobias explained, "When the clarion call of alarm sounds in the name of the Lord, we must silence all noise down here, so we may hear its appeal in the depths of our hearts." When the last notes of the mysterious instrument had died away, we went out to the great park, to watch the sky. Deeply touched, I saw countless luminous points, which looked like splendid little globes, shining in the sky. The clarion, Tobias added, equally moved, is sounded by vigilant entities of a very high plane. Returning to the chambers, the loud noises from the streets and the higher zones of the colony attracted my attention. Tobias left Narcisa in charge of certain important measures for the patients, and invited me to come watch the busy streets with him. On passing through the upper stories, on our way to Government House Square, we noted intense activity in all departments. Seeing my curiosity, Tobias explained, "These crowds are going to the Ministry of Communication for news. The clarion we have just heard is only sounded on extremely serious occasions. We know that it announced war, but it's possible that the Ministry of Communication may give us some particulars. Look at that group going by." Two men and four women were walking along beside us, talking animatedly. "Can you imagine what will become of us in the Ministry of Assistance?" asked one woman. "For many months the number of petitions we have received had been extraordinary. It has been difficult to keep up with the work. And what about us and regeneration?" the older of the two gentlemen exclaimed, "All our activities have been considerably increased. In my department, vigilance against vibrations of the dark realms requires incessant effort. I am wondering what will surprise us next." Tobias touched my arm lightly, whispering, "Let's go and hear what some of the other groups are saying. Is it possible that European war will affect us all?" The other, who seemed remarkably poised, replied serenely, "I see no reason for jumping to hasty conclusion. For the present, there is nothing new but an increase in work, which, in reality, is a blessing. As to the rest, things appear to be following their course. Sickness teaches us to value health, and adversity gives us food for thought. China has been under fire for some time now, and yet you haven't shown any signs of apprehension. But now," explained his rather embarrassed companion, "it seems that I shall have to modify my plan of work." "Helvetius. Helvetians," the other smiled and replied, "let's now forget about my plan of work and think in terms of our plans of work." I turned to Tobias, who was calling my attention to three women to our left who were going in the same direction. The scene was picturesque even here, on an evening of anxious expectation. "I am terribly worried about it," said the youngest of the three ladies, "because Everard mustn't return from the planet just now." "But it seems," one of her friends answered, "that the war won't reach the peninsula. Portugal is a long way from the seat of the war." "But," inquired the third, "why worry about Everard's arrival? What could happen if he came here?" "I'm afraid he would ask for me as his wife," explained the youngest. "I couldn't bear it. He is so ignorant and I couldn't withstand his cruelty again." "Don't be silly," answered the second. "Have you forgotten that he would be kept in the lower zone, or someplace worse?" "Poor thing," Tobias said, smiling, "she fears the liberation of a thoughtless and cruel husband." After a good while, which we spent observing the spiritual multitude, we reached the Ministry of Communication. We waited in front of the vast buildings used for information services. Thousands of entities were anxiously jostling each other. They all wanted information and clarification, and it was impossible to satisfy them. Extremely surprised by the loud clamor, I saw someone on a balcony high up in one of the buildings, asking for their attention. It was an old man of imposing appearance. He announced that the governor would make an appeal within 10 minutes. "It's Minister Aspiridion," Tobias informed me. The noise and confusion subsided, and we heard the governor's voice through numerous loudspeakers, "Brothers of the Astral City, do not give yourselves up to agitation in thought and word. Affliction isn't constructive, anxiety won't uplift us. We must know how to be worthy of the Lord's call. Let us obey the divine will by working silently at our posts." That clear and compelling voice, which spoke with authority and love, had a singular effect on the crowds, In the short space of an hour, the entire colony had returned to its habitual serenity. Chapter 42, The Governor's Address. On the Sunday following the sounding of the clarion, the governor had promised to participate in the regular prayer meeting at the Ministry of Regeneration. The main reason for the visit, Narcisa explained, was the preparation of new schools of aid in the Ministry of Assistance, and of training centers in the Ministry of Regeneration. Even though the conflict is so far away, said Narcisa, we must organize certain specialized first aid services, as well as appropriate training against fear. Against fear? I asked, surprised. Yes. You may not know the high percentage of human lives extinguished simply by the destructive vibrations of terror, which are as contagious as any dangerous epidemic disease. We classify fear as one of mankind's worst enemies, because it settles in the innermost recesses of the soul, undermining its deepest resources of strength. Noting my astonishment, she continued, rest assured. In emergencies such as this, the government values training against fear far above even the nursing courses. Serenity guarantees success. Later, you'll realize the tremendous significance of these measures. I found nothing to say in answer to her. On the eve of the suspicious day, I had the honor of being chosen, along with a great many others, to clean and decorate the large hall which was set aside for the use of the colony's greatest leader. I was understandably apprehensive, as I was about to meet the noble mentor for the first time. I wasn't alone in my feelings, however. A great many of my companions were in the same condition as I. It seemed that the social life of our ministry had begun to center around the great natural hall since dawn that Sunday, when caravans from all departments within the Ministry of Regeneration began to arrive. The great choir of the Government House Temple, together with the choir boys of the Ministry of Elucidation Schools, began the ceremony with a wonderful hymn entitled Always With Thee, Lord Jesus, sung by 2,000 voices. Other singularly beautiful hymns followed, filling the hall with their heavenly music. The gentle murmuring of the perfumed breeze seemed to respond to the soft strains. The entire regeneration staff had received entrance privileges to the enormous green hall, because the prayer meeting was dedicated to them. The other ministries were represented by delegations. For the first time, I had the opportunity to see workers of the ministries of elevation and divine union, who appeared to be clothed in a bright luminous glow. The beauty of the festivities exceeded anything I could possibly have imagined. Musical instruments of sublime vibratory power filled the atmosphere with soft melodies. At 10 o'clock, the governor made his entrance, accompanied by the 12 ministers of regeneration. I shall never forget the noble and imposing figure of that old man, with snow-white hair and remarkably lucid eyes, whose countenance seemed to reflect both the wisdom of age and the energy of youth, the tenderness of the saint and the serenity of the conscientious and just administrator. Tall and slim in his gleaming white tunic, he leaned of a staff despite his youthful gait. Satisfying my curiosity, Celestius told me, the governor has always favored patriarchal attitudes, because he believes that one should always administer with fatherly love. As he took his seat in the place of honor, the children's voices sang a hymn to you, Lord, our lives, accompanied by the melodious strains of harps. The energetic and loving old man glanced at the thousands packed before him, then opened a luminous book, the Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ, my friend told me. Having carefully selected a page, he read slowly, and ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars, see that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. The Master's words, Matthew 24, verse 6. With his voice greatly amplified by electric vibrations, the governor invoked the blessings of Christ. Then, after greeting the representatives of divine union, elevation, elucidation, communication and assistance, he addressed himself to all the workers of our ministry. It is impossible to describe the gentle but firm intonation of that unforgettable voice, at the same time loving and compelling, or to express on paper the exalted purpose of those divinely inspired comments of the gospel, inspired by a profound veneration for sacred matters. Ending his speech, the governor turned to the workers of regeneration and said, Brothers whose labors are more closely connected with earthly activities, it is to you that I address my personal appeal, expecting much of your noble dedication. Let us give the best of ourselves and courage in service. Now that the legions of darkness intensify the difficulties of the lower spheres, it is imperative that we kindle new lights to dissipate the dense shadows obscuring the earth. It is to you, workers of the ministry, that I have dedicated this meeting with my heartfelt trust. At his moment. Therefore, it is not our brothers whose minds already function in the higher planes of life whom I ask to shoulder this gigantic task, but you, who still carry some of the world's dust on your sandals. The Astral City needs 30,000 workers trained in defense service, 30,000 cooperators willing to forego all demands of rest and personal considerations, while our battle is waged against the unleashed forces of ignorance and crime. There will be plenty of work for all in the vibratory border regions between ourselves and the lower planes, for we cannot await the enemy at our gates. In collective organizations, prevention must be considered an essential measure for the preservation of internal peace. We, in the Astral City, are over 1 million people devoted to superior designs and to our own moral improvement. Would it be charitable to allow our colony to be invaded by millions of rebellious spirits? So there must be no hesitation in the defense of the common good. I know that many of you have the great crucified one in mind at this moment. Yes. Jesus gave himself up to a mob of rioters and criminals for the sake of redemption, but he did not hand over the world to disorder and ruin. We should all be ready for individual sacrifices, but we cannot give up our dwelling place to evildoers. Of course, our essential task is of confraternity and peace, love and assistance. It is obvious that we consider all evil as a waste of energy and all crime as a disease of the soul. Yet, we must bear in mind that the Astral City is a divine patrimony, which we must protect with the best energies of our hearts and souls. That which we cannot preserve, we are not worthy to enjoy. Therefore, let us prepare legions of workers to go on missions of fraternal love to Earth and to the lower zones and the regions of darkness, teaching, helping and comforting. But, we must above all organize, here in this ministry, a special legion of defense to safeguard our spiritual attainments within our vibratory frontiers. He went on in this way for a long time, stressing the importance of certain essential measures to be carried out, expounding deep considerations, which I would never be able to reproduce here. He finally closed his address by repeating the verse from Matthew which he had used to begin with, and again invoked Jesus' blessings on all his listeners, so that none of us should receive the divine benefits in vain. Moved and fascinated, I listened to a hymn, which Minister Veneranda had named the Great Jerusalem, sung by the children. As the governor stepped down from the lectern in atmosphere of renewed hope, a gentle breeze, perhaps from distant spheres, showered wonderful, blue rose petals on us all, which melted away as they touched our foreheads, filling our hearts with intense joy. Chapter 43. An informal conversation. The festive atmosphere still prevailed at the Ministry of Regeneration despite the departure of the governor and his closest advisors. There was much talk about the ceremony just over, and hundreds, in response to the appeal of our spiritual leader, were volunteering for this strenuous work of defense. I sought Tobias to consult him about the possibility of my following their example, but my generous brother smiled at my innocence and said, "Andre, you are just beginning a new job. Don't be in a hurry to ask for more responsibilities. The governor has just told us that there will be work for everybody. Don't forget that our chambers of rectification are centers of active work both day and night, and that as 30,000 workers will be detailed for permanent vigilance, there will be great gaps in the rear guard which will have to be filled somehow." Perceiving my disappointment, my kindly companion added, good-humoredly, after a short pause, "Cheer up. You can always enroll yourself in a course against fear. Believe me, it will do you a lot of good." Meanwhile, Isis, who had come to the festival in the delegation from the Ministry of Assistance, sought me and with Tobias' permission I followed him for a quiet talk. "Have you met Minister Benevenitas, of Regeneration?" he inquired, "the one who has just arrived from Poland? I'm afraid I haven't had the pleasure." "Let's go to find him, then." I'll introduce you to him. Lysis continued, sharing with me the vibrations of his great brotherly heart. I've had the honor of counting him among my personal friends for a long time. In a few minutes we found ourselves in a large green park where Benevenitas usually worked. Several groups of visitors were talking here and there under the wide-spreading trees, leading me to the largest gathering where the minister was exchanging impressions with several friends. Lysis introduced me with kind references. Benevenitas welcomed me amiably and cordially included me in his circle. As the conversation proceeded, I noticed that the topic under discussion was the situation on Earth. So painful, the scenes we witnessed. Accustomed as we are to peace in America, none of us had imagined the tremendous difficulties in the work of spiritual aid on the battlefields of Poland. All is darkness and difficulty there. One cannot expect sparks of faith either from aggressors or from the majority of victims, who give themselves up entirely to hideous impressions. Our incarnate brothers offer us no help whatsoever, but merely consume our strength. I must say that, since the beginning of my work, I have never seen such terrible mass suffering. And did the delegation remain there for long? One of those present asked with interest. As long as we could, replied the minister, the head of the expedition. Our colleague from assistance thought it advisable that we apply ourselves solely to the task so that we might take full advantage of the opportunity. I'm afraid we are far from possessing the extraordinary capacity of resistance of those devoted spirit workers on duty there. All the first aid service are working efficiently there, in spite of the suffocating atmosphere, saturated with destructive vibrations. The battlefield, invisible to our earthly brothers, is a real hell of indescribable proportions. Never does the human spirit show so ostensibly the conditions of a fallen soul, with all its diabolic features, as in war. I saw intelligent and cultured men apply themselves with the utmost care to localizing districts of peaceful activity to carry out what they call direct hits. Bombs of high explosive power destroy the patient labors of years. The pestilent emanations of hatred mingled with the poisonous fluids of guns render any service of aid almost impossible. However, what distressed us most was the pitiful conditions of the military aggressors. As they were cut off from their fleshly forms, most of them passed over under the influence of the forces of darkness, and ran away from missionary spirits, calling them all ghosts of the cross. And weren't any rescued? Someone interrupted. The minister answered significantly, "It will always be possible to help peaceful lunatics in their home, but what can we do with the furiously insane but shut them up in an asylum?" There was nothing to be done with such entities but leave them to the abysses of darkness, where they will, in due course, be compelled to change their mental attitude, and open their minds to a new trend of thought. So it's only just that the assistance patrols limit their rescue to those with some probability of assimilating help from above. Thus, my dear friends, you see that on every account our observations were sad indeed. Availing himself of the pause in the conversation, one member of the group remarked, "Lack of religious preparation, my friends," declared Benevenitas. "A cultivated intelligence is not enough. Man must, above all, enlighten his spirit in things eternal. All creeds are holy in their fundamentals and their representatives only carry out a divine mission when they teach the truth of God. They'll never be able to quench the spiritual thirst of civilization if they drift into political or worldly channels. Without the divine breath, religious personalities may inspire respect and admiration, but never faith and trust." "But what about spirit communication?" someone asked abruptly. "Didn't its first manifestations take place in America and Europe over 50 years ago? Isn't that new movement continuing to spread the eternal truth?" Benevenitas smiled, and gestured, and went on explaining, "The Spiritist doctrine is our great hope, and in every respect the comforter for incarnate man, but its progress is still very slow. It is a divine gift, which most men haven't eyes to see, as yet. An overwhelming percentage of new adepts approach the divine source still under the influence of old religious vices. They want to reap its benefits, but are unwilling to give anything of themselves. They invoke the truth, but don't go in search of it. While the studious ones reduce mediums to mere human guinea pig, numerous believers act like certain patients who, though completely healed, believe more in sickness than in health, and never come to stand on their own feet. In a word, over there, they're after materialized spirits for the performance of transitory phenomena, whereas here we spend our time looking for spiritualized men to carry out serious work. The minister's play on words brought a good-humored response from his listeners. Our task is really astronomical, he resumed gravely. However, we must bear in mind that every man is a divine seed. Let's undertake our mission with hope and optimism, for if we do our share to the best of our power, we may rest assured that God will do the rest. Chapter 44, The Dark Regions. Adding to the happiness of this reunion, Liza surprised me with his great culture and sensitivity. He played some old songs expertly on his zither, reminding me of music on earth. What a wonderful day! More spiritual joys followed in succession, as if we were in heaven. When at last I found myself alone with my kind friend from assistance, I tried to tell him of my impressions. "Have no doubt," he said, smiling, "that when we are in the company of those we love, something comforting and constructive goes on inside us. It's the nourishment of love, Andre. When souls join in the pursuit of some common interest, their thoughts mingle, forming centers of living forces through which, from the general vibration, each member of the group will receive his share of joy or suffering. That's why, on the planet, environment is such an important factor in every man's life. We shall always feed on what we cultivate. If we give in to feelings of sadness, we shall become slaves of them. If we are unduly absorbed by the ideas of sickness, we shall suffer their consequences. There's no mystery. It's a law of life which works for good or evil. Wherever an atmosphere of brotherhood, hope, love or joy prevails, we shall carry with us a share of those feelings. On the other hand, when we shall leave a gathering where inferior tendencies of selfishness, vanity or crime predominate, we carry the destructive vibration of those feelings." "You're right," I exclaimed. "I can see that life in earthly homes is equally ruled by these principles. Whenever there is mutual understanding, life becomes a forced state of heavenly bliss, but if misunderstandings and unkindness prevail, home becomes a real hell on earth." Liza agreed with a smile. I then took the opportunity to ask about something which had been puzzling me. The governor, in his address, had mentioned the spheres of earth, the shadowy zone, and darkness. I had never heard any mention of darkness previously. I wondered whether that dark region could be the shadowy zone itself, where I myself had spent several wandering in dense shadows. Weren't there numerous deranged entities and patients of all sorts from the shadowy zone in the chambers? Remembering that Liza's had given me some valuable information about my own condition on my arrival in the Astral City, I told him of my doubts and questions. With a noteworthy expression on his face, my friend explained, "We call the lowest regions we know darkness. Let's consider all the creatures as travelers in life. A few of them advance resolutely on the way towards the essential object of the journey. These are already spiritually evolved and, conscious of the divine essence within themselves, they progress without hesitating towards their sublime goal. Most, however, linger along the road. Numberless souls spend centuries repeating the same experience. While the former advance along straight lines, the latter travel along the same circular path. Thus failing, recommencing, and failing again, they are exposed to endless vicissitudes. Many will go astray in the forest of life, bewildered by the labyrinth they have themselves traced. To that class belong the millions of beings wandering in the shadowy zones. Others, because of their selfish thoughts, walk in the dark and will often fall into precipices where they will remain for an indefinite time. Do you see now?" The explanation could not have been clearer. Impressed by the length and complexity of the subject, I went on with my questions. "But what about those falls? Do they only happen on the earth? Are only the incarnate likely to be hurled into abysses?" After a moment's reflection, Lysis replied, "That is a good observation. Wherever he is, the spirit may hurl himself into the abysses of evil. However, in the higher spheres the defenses are stronger. Therefore the responsibility of the fault committed is also greater." "Yet," I insisted, I thought that a fall wouldn't be possible except on Earth. It seemed to me that the divine atmosphere, the knowledge of truth and of higher aid would be infallible protection against the poison of vanity and temptation. My friend smiled and went on, the problem of temptation is more complex. The earth itself is filled with divine atmosphere, knowledge of the truth, and heavenly assistance. Yet so many fight destructive battles while surrounded by sheltering trees and flowering fields. Many others commit murders by moonlight, insensible to the soothing language of the stars. Others oppress the weaker fellow while hearing around them sublime revelations of truth. Indeed, the earth doesn't lack expressions of divine presence. Liza's words sang deeply into my spirit. It is true that, in general, battles are fought in spring and summer when nature displays its treasures of color, perfume and light on the ground and in the sky, while burglary and murder are preferably committed at night, when the moon and stars involve the earth in an atmosphere of celestial poetry. Most earthly tyrants are men of great culture who have turned their backs on divine inspiration. Although my conception about the spiritual fall had changed, my curiosity was not yet satisfied. Now, Isis, could you give me an idea where the region of darkness is located? If the lower zone is connected with the human mind, where is this place of suffering and horror? There are spheres of life everywhere. My friend resumed, the void is merely a literary image. Everywhere there are living forces and each species of beings moves in a special zone of life. After a short pause, during which he seemed to reflect deeply, he went on, of course, as happens to most of us, you place the sphere of life after the death of the physical body in the zones right above the surface of the globe, unaware of those below it. Yet life pulsates in the depths of the ocean and the bowels of the earth. Besides, the spirit obeys the principles of gravity, just as do material bodies. The earth isn't only a field of action which we may disregard and misuse at our will. It is a live organization, with certain laws which will either enslave us or set us free, according to our actions. It's obvious that the soul overburdened with faults won't be able to ascend to the surface of the wonderful lake of life. We must bear in mind that free birds may rise to great heights, those encircled in dense thickets of reeds will find great difficulty in taking flight, and those tied to great weights become mere slaves of the unknown. Do you grasp my point? Lysus didn't need to ask that question. All of a sudden, the immense field of the redeeming struggles in the lowermost zones of life seemed to flash before my spiritual eyes. As if in need of carefully waiting his next words, Lysus thought and thought, and then began again, just as we carry in the recesses of our beings the potential for good and evil, so the planet possesses both high and low expressions, with which to correct the guilty and open the passages to life eternal to those who triumph. As a doctor on Earth, you learn that a man's brain contains certain elements which control his sense of direction. Now you realize that those elements aren't really physical, but spiritual in essence. If you live exclusively in the dark, you will dim your divine sense of direction and end by hurling yourself into the shadows, for abysses attract abysses. Each of us shall reach the goal towards which he directs his steps. Chapter 45, The Music Fields. Towards evening, Lysus invited me to accompany him to the music fields. You must relax a little, Andre, he said kindly. Seeing my reluctance, he added, I'll speak to Tobias. Narcisa herself has taken the day off to rest. Come on. By now I noticed a singular change in myself. Despite the short time I had been working there, I felt greatly attached to the chambers of rectification. Minister Genesius' daily visits, Narcisa's company, Tobias's inspiring example and my fellow workers' companionship had touched me deeply. Narcisa, Celestius and I spent all our leisure time trying to make little improvements in the place, to make it more cheerful and comfortable for the patients, whom we loved with all our hearts. Considering my relatively new position in the chambers, I needed Tobias' permission to go out, so we both went in search of him. With respectful familiarity, Lysus talked to my instructor, who readily agreed, good idea. Andre must get acquainted with the music fields. Patting me affectionately on the back, he added, go and enjoy yourself. Come back late in the evening, whenever you like. All our different branches of service are well attended. I followed Lysis to his home in the Ministry of Assistance. It was a true pleasure to see Laura again, and to learn that Heloise's devoted mother would be returning from the earth the following week. The house was filled with joy. Both the area indoors and the garden were more beautiful than ever.